Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
The very first question anybody asked about you was simple: boy or girl? But what happens when the answer is not so simple? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. For a long time, our culture assumed that a baby's biological sex could tell you something important, even essential, about that baby's future identity. But while most of us are born with unmistakable physical characteristics that determine our sex, and most of us feel like the gender that matches that sex, scientists are discovering new information about the relationship between our genes, our biological sex, and the way we feel and inhabit our gender that demonstrates how much we still have to learn. Science writer Robin Morantz-Hennig wrote the story Rethinking Gender for the special January issue of National Geographic called Gender Revolution. She joins us this hour from the studios of Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. Robin, I think we have you back with us.
Yes, you do. I'm sorry, Chris.
Let's start again with this question about how chromosomes determine the sex of a baby if the development of that baby is typical.
Mm-hmm. Well, even if all goes well, there's an XY fetus that has something on the Y chromosome that says, turn all of these proto-gonads into male gonads, you know, develop a testes and secrete testosterone, and everything will become male-like. And if that gene does not exist and it's an XX fetus, then everything becomes female-like. But even in more times than we realize, perhaps as many as one times in 100, the XX doesn't always develop everything according to a female program, and the XY doesn't always develop everything according to a male program. So that very basic thing we learned in high school biology, that XX is female and XY is male, isn't always correct. That's how complicated sex and gender can be.
Yeah, and this phenomenon has probably been with us forever, right? So although we're just becoming aware that there are folks living among us who may not sort of conform to traditional just physiological sex characteristics or gender norms, they've probably walked the earth since humans have walked the earth.
Yes, they probably have, and there have been different ways that society has accommodated them. In some cultures, there actually is what's come to be known as a third gender, which I talked about in the Geographic article. These are generally anatomical males who don't feel exactly male from the time of childhood and are allowed to express their gender identity, their female gender identity, while retaining a male body. Sort of in traditional cultures, there has been a place for people who don't quite fit into the typical gender binary.
What's really interesting about that is that we like to think of ourselves in an industrialized society as somehow being more modern and more accepting of the science of things, and yet we tend to prefer this kind of line in the sand definition between male and female.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of things much easier. You know, the either or makes so much of daily life easier, you know, where you get your clothes, how people address you, which pronouns we use, which bathrooms we use. And muddying it up is something that's hard for a lot of people to accommodate. And this is, you know, I couldn't get real numbers for how many of us really identify as a gender that doesn't quite fit into the gender binary. It's probably a very small percentage. It's probably less than 1%. But even those of us who pretty quickly say, you know, I'm male or female, probably can resonate somewhat to feeling like you're not exactly the way the stereotypical male or female is supposed to be, that there's elements of yourself that do kind of blend into someplace across the spectrum.
Well, to what extent is our view of what it means to act like a male or a female shaped by culture?
To a great extent. That's like a continuing debate, isn't it, about whether there's such a thing as an inborn way of being male or female. I mean, certainly the genitals are biological, and whether your reproductive role is can be biological, but the sense of yourself as male or female or some, you know, different combination of those is often considered to be quite cultural.
There's also the possibility for a person to be born intersex. What does that mean?
Well, intersex is different from transgender, and it's a whole sort of hornet's nest of a definition, because some people who consider themselves intersex like to call it something like DSD, differences of sexual development, or disorders of sexual development. And some people in the intersex community don't like that designation because it sounds so medicalized.
Hmm.
But it can mean, all it really means is that the different elements of your gender, your anatomy, your chromosomes, and your gender identity don't necessarily all line up for one reason or another. And there's a variety of reasons. I mean, sometimes it's because your body, like every cell in your body, is incapable of responding to the signals that the male hormone testosterone sends out. And when that happens, you have the chromosomes of a male, but you haven't converted anything to the genitalia of a male because your body is incapable of doing that. So you look physically like a female and often have a gender identity as a female. That's just one of an assortment of different biological explanations for why people might have a disconnect between their chromosomes, their genitals, and their gender identity.
Not long ago, intersex children were simply told they were one gender or another and then possibly surgically treated to make their anatomies match. We should note that probably this was done by people who thought they had the children's best interest in mind, but it's not a practice that is recommended today.
Right. Well, what you mentioned at the top of the hour, that the very first question people ask is it a boy or a girl?
Yeah.
You know, when a child is born with what's known as ambiguous genitalia, with genitals that can't quite identify as one way or another, the doctor is left saying, I don't know, to a question like that. That's something that parents don't really know how to handle. And so for the sake of everybody's convenience, I guess, the assumption at least 25, 50 years ago was that they should just turn the genitals into one or the other, tell the parents that's what they had, tell the child that's what the child was, and everybody would be none the wiser. But it turns out that that's really frowned upon now. What they tended to do was generally cut off whatever looked like it was sort of like a penis and turn the child into a girl, because that was the easier surgery. And a lot of those children grew up unhappy and found out what had happened to them, and it was not something that was considered the right way to react to a situation like that. What they do now is assign the child a gender, generally based on the child's chromosomes, and try that out for a while. You know, don't do the surgery, but just sort of explain to the parents what the situation is, give the child one gender or the other, and then see how the child develops and see what kind of gender comes into play.
In the course of your reporting, Robin, did you get a sense for why we are so uncomfortable in general with ambiguity in gender when we've come to accept a lot of other differences in people and not really bat an eyelash at them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, anything related to sex and gender is fraught. So I think that there's a lot of that. I don't know. I think it's also, you know, for those of us who feel ourselves really as being on the binary, being just either male or female, it's really hard to sort of get yourself into that headspace, I think, of not feeling like either or feeling like a little bit of each or feeling like one morning you wake up feeling male and the next morning you wake up feeling female. Or, you know, it's just hard to really wrap your head around that for the vast majority of people who are binary. So maybe that's why people get sort of worked up about it. But I think it's mostly just that we're kind of prudish about a lot of things that relate to sex and gender.
We're speaking this hour with science writer Robin Marantz-Hennig. Her article, Rethinking Gender, appears in a special January issue of National Geographic called Gender Revolution. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
The best thing about being a boy is, like, a boy is very sporty.
The best thing being a girl is because that girls can do a little bit more things than boys can.
The best thing about being a girl is now I don't have to pretend to be a boy.
The worst thing about being a girl is that you just can't do things that boys can do.
The worst thing about being a boy is your underarm stinks.
Like, it kind of bothers me how there was not one girl president. One thing I wish I could do, but I can't because I'm a girl, is I can't be treated like I wanted to.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard children featured in National Geographic's January issue, Gender Revolution. We're speaking this hour with science writer Robin Marantz-Hennig, who wrote a piece for that issue called Rethinking Gender. It's about the science of gender and sex. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So interesting to hear those children talking about their understanding of their own gender and other genders. We know now that there are a lot of children who recognize in childhood that, not a lot of children, but a lot of people who will be transgender recognize in childhood that there is something different about them. And there are a lot of interesting questions, Robin, about how parents and medical officials should handle this declaration from a child.
People are confused about what it means for a three-year-old to say, I'm really a girl, when that child was identified at birth as a boy. How could the child know that? What does it mean for the child to say, I'm a girl? What's the parent supposed to do about it? And there's some debate about whether parents should go ahead and allow the child to change gender identity and present to the world as a girl or not. You know, maybe what the child is saying is, I like girlish things. I feel like I like to play with dolls, even though everybody, the world is telling me that boys don't do that, and is really a child who's just expressing his boyishness in a non-traditional way. So it becomes very complex about what a parent should do when a child is so insistent on being mislabeled as the gender assigned at birth.
Is there any consensus on when a child's sense of a transgender gender identity can be sort of trusted and should be acted upon by parents?
Well, not necessarily flatly by age, but by, you know, what one therapist I spoke to repeated the mantra that a lot of therapists are saying, that if the child is consistent, insistent, and persistent in the gender belief, that the child probably really knows what he or she is talking about, and that the parents should listen carefully and should do what they can to allow for a transition. And what has also started to happen, which is there is a consensus about this, is that as the child approaches puberty and might go through puberty in the biological gender rather than the gender that the child feels him or herself to be, you can actually administer drugs called puberty blockers that will kind of allow the child to stay childish until about the age of 16, and then you would expect that the real sense of whether he's really a boy or a girl would really start to crystallize, and then you could get the child off puberty blockers and either allow the child to continue on developing in the biological gender that the child was born into, or start taking cross-gender hormones and actually begin a transgender transition.
And so the medical case there is that delaying puberty can ultimately be reversed. Once the puberty blockers stop, the body will do what the body will do. But if a child has proceeded into puberty, it's really hard to change some of those secondary sex characteristics.
Exactly. Thank you for stating it so clearly. But that is what happens. Say you've got a girl who insists, somebody identified at birth as a girl who by the time that child is maybe 10 or so, says, I'm really a boy and I really don't want to turn out to be female. If you put that child on puberty blockers, there won't be the development of breasts that will eventually have to be removed if the child decides to really transition to male. Same with a biological male, you won't get the excess hair, you won't get the Adam's apple and the deep voice, things that are very hard to change surgically after the transition to becoming a transgender female.
Right, I want to go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Let's speak first to Brooke in Fort Worth. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. When I was listening to the show earlier, and there was obviously some technical difficulties, and I was afraid I missed this, but I'm curious if there has been clear research that can identify people who feel transgender, who feel like they're a different gender. There is scientific support behind that, meaning that there's testing that can be done to show that indeed there is an issue with the chromosomes, and that may be contributing to their difficulty with gender identity.
What do you know about that, Robin?
Well, unfortunately, there's not a quick and easy medical test. And what there really isn't enough of, and I was disheartened to find this in my research, is even any understanding of what's really going on in the body and brain of somebody who feels transgender. There have been some attempts to look at the brain of transgender individuals to see whether they actually look more like, I mean, there's a certain degree of what's called sexual dimorphism in brains. There's a certain amount of, structures that look one way in female brains and a different way in male brains. And so when you look at those structures in transgender individuals, they often look more like the brains of their chosen gender than their biological gender, which suggests that something different happened, probably in utero, in the development of the brain and the development of the genitals. But that's only the very, very beginning of any scientific understanding of what's really happening. And so, the idea that there might be some test that you can do when your, 5-year-old says, I'm really a boy, and then you can see whether it's really serious or something that can be explained, they're very far from anything like that now.
Many people are beginning to think about the idea that gender may be less binary than we were raised to believe. There are also people who think of themselves as being without gender. How can they live out that identity successfully in a culture like ours and like many around the world that is so heavily reliant on sex-specific pronouns, for one?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's probably one of the most difficult situations for an individual to be in because of things like just our language and our insistence on reading people as one or the other. But there's a sort of a slight move afoot now for people to make very clear what their preferred pronoun is. A lot of people who feel themselves to be either non-binary or agender will choose a pronoun like they instead of he or she, or will make up a pronoun, which gets tricky when you're trying to talk to people or certainly when you're trying to write about people, but is something that has to be sort of taken in as one of the things that you ask people. How do you want to be referred to? How do you identify? The idea of being agender and yet having to wake up every morning putting on clothes and wearing a hairstyle, that's something that, that people in that situation have to sort of struggle with every day.
And are there people who sort of experiment with they or a third kind of pronoun and then revert back to either he or she, even though they don't quite fit, simply because of it's a lot of work to communicate to the outer world every day that you prefer this other pronoun?
Right. Well, I don't know if, they probably move around pronouns a lot, including, the person I follow the most closely in my article, somebody I call E, actually used the she pronoun that she was born with when I first met her. This was a child who was 14 to 15 over the course of the time I knew her. And by the time I was finished interviewing E, they had chosen to use the pronoun they. And I don't know, at some point I think E is going to actually transition to male and will probably use the pronoun he. So not only are they pronouns, that people try on and reject, but there are entire identities that people try on and reject. Many of the young people I spoke to sort of went through a succession of different possible identities, including sexual identities. Like some young females who didn't feel exactly typically female thought for a while, okay, maybe I'm a butch lesbian, and they tried that for a while, and that didn't feel right, and so they moved on to, well, then maybe I'm a trans guy, or maybe I'm non-binary, or, they were experimenting just as adolescents experiment in all sorts of ways of identifying themselves. This is an additional way and a relatively new way that people are trying on different guises.
That's an interesting phenomenon because just as, I think cisgender people who feel like the gender they were the sex they were born, sometimes wish that there were like a test or something very obvious. People who are experiencing differences in gender identities also maybe long for a positive, definitive feeling that they really have to work for.
I think they do. Several young people I spoke to, it was very interesting to me, found themselves reading books that featured, heroes or heroines of one gender identity or another, and that was how they tested how they were feeling. They sort of tweaked themselves to see, okay, is this working for me? Am I like this character I'm reading about? So the fact that there is now in young adult literature, there's more and more treatment of transgender issues, that's a real help for a lot of people.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Robin Marantz-Hennig. Her article, Rethinking Gender, appears in a special January issue of National Geographic titled Gender Revolution. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I wanted you guys to speak on, I'm glad that you brought up sexuality or sexual orientation just a moment ago, but do you think that it's possible that stigma on sexual orientation has something to do with people accepting gender identity as like a scientific problem that exists in people in real life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. People talk about gender identity and sexual orientation as, they're very distinct. Sexual orientation is who you go to bed with, and gender identity is who you go to bed as, which is an interesting way of thinking about it. But there's one school of thought that, we talked earlier about what to do when a child is telling you that the child is the wrong gender. And there's one school of thought that if you just allow the child to sort of express all the likes and dislikes that he wants to, that he will grow up to be not necessarily transgender, but gay. Among the parents that I spoke to, I didn't get the feeling that there was a homophobic reaction to that. In fact, I had the feeling that a lot of parents were thinking, gee, this would be a lot simpler if my child were gay than if my child is transgender.
Yeah.
And it is a lot simpler because, it's no easy task to change your gender. It requires a lifetime of hormonal treatment, sometimes surgical therapy and sometimes not. The surgery is sort of a secondary issue, but always it will require hormones. And so you're doing some major changes on your physical body. So, you know, having a gay sexual orientation doesn't require any of that.
People get really hung up about issues that have anything to do with gender or sexuality as regards children. And when we were fixing our technical delays, I was talking about the fact that the cover of this issue of National Geographic has a little girl on it, and her name is Avery Jackson. She's 9, and she happens to be transgender. Can you talk a little bit about the thought that went into the decision to feature her on the cover?
Unfortunately, I can't. I'm a freelance writer, so I'm not part of any of that decision making. I know that they were very proud of that whole feature that she's part of. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the children who are 9 years old all around the world talking about their gender identity and what it means to be a boy or a girl. You know, my sense is that she ended up on the cover because it's just a gorgeous photo. It's a gorgeous photo, and she's pink all over, including her hair. And it's very dramatic and really reflective of the fact that, you know, your sense of National Geographic as a hoary old, you know, eternal kind of publication is really turned upside down in this whole issue, because my experience with them has been that they are very careful about addressing issues of gender identity in the most sensitive and modern way possible. And I think that that's reflected in Avery's picture on the cover.
I thought the other striking thing about it was that it's a beautiful photograph, as you say, and if you didn't know the context, you would just think, what a cute little girl.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We're going to take a question, and then we will get the answer after our break. Let's see. We will speak with Rose in Houston. Hi, Rose.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. My question was, through your research, Robin, was there a certain country that stood out or has been shown to be the leader for acceptance of gender nonconforming people, whether through, you mentioned language as being part of culture, or politically through legislation? Was there any certain country, I assumed, other than the U.S., which I assumed you were referring to when you mentioned that we think of these things in sort of like a prudish fashion?
Okay, Rose, thank you so much for the question. We will get an answer to it from my guest, science writer Robin Morantz-Hennig, in just a couple of minutes after this break. Robin is the author of an article called Rethinking Gender that appears in a special January issue of National Geographic called Gender Revolution. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science writer Robin Morantz-Hennig, who's written a piece called Rethinking Gender, about the science of gender understanding and identity. It appears in a special January issue of National Geographic. Before the break, we heard from Rose, who wanted to know about different countries and how they deal with transgender folks. And there is a really nice infographic contained within the text of your story, Robin.
Right. And unfortunately, I don't have that in front of me, but I guess you do.
I do.
I know that there's a big range in how well countries can handle the fact that some people are transgender. I know that in some countries, there's actually some attempts to remove the either-or gender identity in something like passports, you know, which there's no real reason for you to identify as either male or female on your passport, and taking that away is a reflection of some sensitivity to the fact that some people identify as neither. And In the United States, there's a big variation from state to state about what kind of bathrooms people are allowed to use and all sorts of other ways that we can reflect our acceptance or non-acceptance of transgender individuals. I did travel to Samoa, where it's said to be one of the best places in the world to have a third gender identity. I think I refer to this earlier, that there's this third gender in Samoa known as the Fafafine, who are born male, remain anatomical males their whole lives, and yet take on the social and cultural and gender identity roles of a female. And that is their gender identity. They're not male, they're not female, they're Fafafine. Their sexual partners are males, and males who think of themselves as straight males because they're attracted to the female side of the Fafafine identity. And the Fafafines don't have sex with each other, only with straight males. And in Samoa, they actually take on all sorts of public roles, are generally accepted publicly in a way that is kind of hard for Americans to understand. There is no real clear analogy in American culture.
Yeah. We have an email here from Dawn, who writes, "Our child just came out as transgender a couple of months ago. She's 12, and I have to say this has been one of the most difficult times in our lives as we had no idea our child felt this way. On the other hand, she's the happiest she's ever been now, so that's comforting. One of the biggest hurdles is other people and how they will treat her and balancing that with our need to protect our child. Do you have any advice for people who can't seem to get their heads around what's going on with our child?"
Yeah, it's a really difficult time in the lives of families. You know, the best advice is to try to find support groups. I know that where I live in New York City, and there are lots of support groups for families in this situation. And I don't know if there are any local ones where this person is, but there are actually online support groups as well. Because talking to other parents in that situation is really quite helpful. And, you know, one of the big questions is to what extent the rest of the world needs to actually know the child's full story. You know, if she presents as a girl now and is seen as a girl by the world at large, then maybe that's enough information for people. And if she can sort of live her life as a girl, at least for now. If she's 12, though, she's also facing puberty, and probably there'll be some need to start talking to physicians as well about possibly starting puberty blockers or figuring out what to do next biologically.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Mark calling from San Antonio. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Well, first I wanted to real quickly, because you mentioned the thing with the Samoans. There's something about back in the history of the Iroquois Indians that's similar to that. I can't remember all the details of it, but there's something very similar to that. That's, if you don't already know, that might be something worth looking into. But my comment that I called for was in reference to the fact that our culture that we live in really has a narrow definition of what it means to be male and what it means to be female. And it's almost like a list of do's and don'ts. And if somebody goes outside of those perimeters, they're either considered to be transgender, which we hear a lot now, but I would say a few years ago we didn't hear a lot of that. A few years ago, all we heard was they were either straight or gay.
Well, what about that, Robin? Do you have the sense, or, you know, do scientists have the sense that if culture has a big effect on our understanding of gender, is it possible that a culture that was a little bit allowed people to be a little bit freer in their expression of gender, people wouldn't necessarily feel the need to be a gender different from their sex?
Yeah, that is a possibility. I mean, the other way of thinking of it is that now that we're talking about gender as a spectrum, which is something that, like, at the moment, the majority of young people who were surveyed recently agree is the case, which is something new, you know, to think of gender as a spectrum rather than a binary. The fact that we're thinking of it that way actually maybe frees up people to define themselves in a more open-ended way. You know, a generation ago, transgender people who, especially like men who always felt like they were really female, who then transitioned in adulthood to become transgender women, somebody like Caitlyn Jenner, would actually become almost stereotypically super feminine women. You know, there was an either-or sense in transitioning a generation ago. Now, people who transition aren't necessarily taking on all the trappings of the other gender. They're taking on the trappings that feel right to them. So we're actually in a better place.
I was going to say that feels like progress, that people can just be who they are.
Right, right. But what it also does is it opens up the possibility to questioning adolescents who are just trying to figure out who they are. It opens up the possibility that the gender they were assigned is wrong. And that just makes, you know, their uncertainties even more uncertain about so many aspects of themselves.
You note in the piece that a majority of millennials really seem to look at gender along a spectrum as rather than really binary, as previous generations have. I have four teenagers. All of them do or have gone to school with somebody who is transgender, and it doesn't really seem to be a big deal for them. It's just their classmate. And I wonder what it is about this rising generation that is maybe different from those who've come before.
Yeah, I think that they're a much more tolerant generation in all sorts of ways, in terms of gender expression and gender identity, in terms of racial acceptance. I think that that's all good signs, you know, that they take people for who they are, and they don't really work too hard to put people into boxes.
We have an email here from Brandy who writes and wants to know, did you do any research or talk with any trans people who don't want to transition, and I'm assuming Brandy means physiologically, but still consider themselves a trans man or woman?
Maybe who don't want to do surgery but still want to live as the opposite gender?
Right, surgery or hormones, yeah.
Yeah, I spoke to a lot of people like that. And, you know, it's a very individual decision about how far to go with living as the opposite gender. You know, people, and it seems to me, at least the older generation, the ones who sort of fought these feelings for much of their lives, married, had children in the biological gender they were born with, and then decided to transition anyway in their 40s, 50s, even 60s. It seems as though there's a progression in what they do. First, they just dress as the opposite gender and go out in the world and identify, you know, socially in the other gender, and then think about maybe taking hormones, and beyond that, then think about maybe doing surgery. But that very first step of wearing the clothes of the other gender and taking on the social trappings is enough, really, for many people to consider themselves transgender.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is science writer Robin Marantz Hennig. We're talking about her recent National Geographic article, current article called Rethinking Gender. Let's go on the phones now to Toby in Duncanville. Hi, Toby.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
So I'm actually transgender, and in my personal experience, and a lot of other people have to do this as well, we had to go see a therapist first in order to start hormone treatment. You have to have the therapist confirm that you're actually trans, and they give you a referral and give you a letter that says you can start your hormone treatments. But I know it isn't the case everywhere. Some people can just go to the doctor and start hormones without seeing a therapist. So I was wondering what your opinion is, like whether the therapy should be required, whether it shouldn't be.
Before we get Robin's answer, Toby, can I ask if you felt like it was invasive?
A little bit. In some cases, I had some questions that were I remember comments about the way I dressed that my therapist said, you know, didn't seem very masculine and stuff like that. And I, in general, got a feeling that she kind of doubted me throughout the therapy, but in the end she said it was really my choice.
All right, thanks very much for your call.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked a follow-up question, Chris. I'm also curious about how old Toby was at the time.
Let's see if we can, if we still have Toby on the line. How old are you or were you, Toby?
I'm 19. I was 18 when I went into therapy.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I think, I mean, it might feel like it's obnoxious and one extra step and, you know, sort of insulting, but it's probably a good idea for a person who feels transgender to talk to somebody. I mean, not necessarily as a sort of requirement to get the hormones, but I think that, that therapy can be really helpful in understanding that this is actually what you mean. Because there are possibly some feelings that don't necessarily mean that you need to transition to the other gender or need to take cross-sex hormones. And so just talking through with either a professional or even a peer is probably a really good idea.
I don't want to justify any kind of bias or unkindness to people who have a non-traditional gender identity, but it is a lot for some people who were raised in what appeared to be a binary cisgender world to take in. This has been with us for a long time, but we haven't really talked about it or acknowledged it until quite recently. Can you talk about, did you learn anything about, you know, families who have sort of successfully open their minds and hearts to somebody who has a transgender identity?
Yeah, most of the people I spoke to, their parents had been incredibly supportive. Often there's one parent who's a little bit more resistant, but it was really striking to me how the parents were just willing to do whatever it took to have a happy child. And more than once they were told, you can have a happy daughter or a dead son, you decide. I mean, that's almost what it amounted to sometimes, because the distress is so profound if you're feeling like you're in the wrong gender. So parents were pretty quick to come around to realizing that their child really meant it, and they would move mountains to make it something that was a safe and possible thing to happen for the child.
This piece made me think a lot about the fact that although I suppose I felt female my entire life, I couldn't exactly define that for you or for anybody. And people who have a transgender identity have to do that for themselves and for other people.
Right. I was very aware of that as well. I don't even know what it means to feel female. It was not anything that I ever wondered about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, trying to put a name to what one's own gender identity really feels like and how to really explain it, that's very difficult. But I was very impressed by how consistently people who didn't feel like they had the right gender identity just knew that something was amiss. One of the kids I spoke to said it's like ordering some shoes online, and you get them and you know that they're supposed to fit, the size is right, but they just feel uncomfortable and you don't know why. You know, I guess that it's as vague as that, but as unsettling and as consistent as that for the people who just are not feeling like they have the right gender identity yet.
Science writer Robin Marantz-Hennig wrote the story Rethinking Gender for the January issue of National Geographic. Robin, thank you for hanging with us through our technical snafus. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.